Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. We're here Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at those times. We archive the podcasts at the radio show's page at richarddugan.com. Also on SoundCloud and iTunes, so we hope that you will take a listen to the interviews. And also a reminder that these interviews are not necessarily the 50 minutes that you hear on the radio. Sometimes there's more, and we're certainly hoping so with this program as well. Returning guest to our program, Rutley Weiniger is our guest, and am I correct? Psychotherapist?
I'm a psychologist.
Therapist. And a therapist. So a psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist, yeah.
I always, whenever I have folks in here who have the moniker regarding dealing with the mind and the psyche, I always worry. I wonder if they're checking me out and making sure I'm stable. there are times when I wonder if I am, because as we all do from time to time, we tend to get into these different moods. One of the things that I wanted to discuss on this program today, and we're going to go all over the place today, actually, has to do with this, what's been termed, I don't know that I'd want to call it an epidemic, because I think epidemics are more akin to some kind of a virus or bacterial infection that's spreading, like they talk about the flu, an epidemic, you know. I didn't get the flu. I also didn't get the flu shot, and haven't for 30 or 40 years, as far as I know, because I'd like to think my immune system has been built up sufficiently to fight off these things. And you know what? If I were to get sick and be laid up for a day or two and have the fever and all of that stuff, terrific, because now I'm strengthening the immune system. How do we do that on a psychological level, especially with this epidemic that we've got, not just across the country, but I think it may be very well around the world, and I don't know what the statistics are, regarding people wanting to leave, wanting to take their own lives because they're they're whatever it is that they're feeling, whether they're frustrated with the outside world or they have feelings of inferiority or whatever they are within themselves. Can we talk a little bit? Let's kind of start there.
Well, you know, first this is Rutley Weiniger. Hello, good morning. What I was thinking when you talked about epidemic. I thought the epidemic you would call out is the ice age of the heart. What I call the ice age of the heart.
Yeah, and we're going to deal with that too.
Because I think that leads to the other epidemic.
Yes, yes.
I don't think it's disconnected. You know, it's like...
Well, then let's start with that. The ice age of the heart. I like the terminology.
Yeah, you know, that's why I wrote my book... Hard work, the path of self-compassion, compassion for others and for our world.
Yeah.
Because it seems that we are at this real crossroad in history.
Yeah.
Where we wonder, will we care? Will we be a human race that cares?
Yeah.
That cares for more than ourselves? And maybe more for what we call as psychologists, our self-objects. Let's say our kids, near and dear blood-related ones.
Mm-hmm.
Can we afford to care for others?
Yeah.
Can we include others in our care, whether they are from our cultural frame or beyond our cultural frame, whether they are humans, other sentient beings, our earth. And it seems we are really coming to this crossroad, caring or not caring.
Yeah.
But it's actually even more dramatic, because not caring at this point could have, on a bigger, huge environmental level, the consequence of extinction. You know, if we don't pull it together as a humanity, and I don't want to go to environmentalism instead of humans,
I
think...
Let's stay with the human being, because the reality is we may not destroy ourselves with the various weapons that are out there. Supposedly, we had this wonderful treaty, what have you, with North Korea, and that's wonderful. That's great. I think that's a good start. But that's not where we're going to destroy ourselves. Not at that level. It's more on a more personal level, a more intimate community level. That's right. Where the destruction is taking place.
Well, I was wondering, though, let me just say that the very real environmental challenge, where maybe big parts of the world might be inhabitable, has something to do with that. There's a very interesting theory, which it's called terror management theory by Brzezinski, Greenberg, and Salomon. Mm-hmm. They're three professors, sociology professors from the East Coast. And they have written about the Holocaust, 9/11. I'm sure they're writing a book right now. And they are saying if a group of people is threatened by annihilation or by great fear, that they become more conservative, they circle their wagons, and they pick on another group, usually a minority, which, you know, were the Jews in the Second World War or the Muslims in 9/11, to boost their own self-esteem. So if I, you know, wounded as I am and scared as I am of possible extinction or whatever other fear there might be, if I then pick on another group, then I basically divert attention from myself. Mm-hmm. And by picking on somebody who's smaller, we all know that from the schoolyard.
Yeah, I do.
Then what Brzezinski and Greenberg call the terror management processes are set in motion, and we gain higher self-esteem by picking on somebody else.
Is that actually self-esteem, though?
Well, it's a false sense of self-esteem, okay. But it feels like it.
Yeah.
It feels to the populace like raised self-esteem. Yes, maybe I'm sitting in a trailer or I don't have a job, but I can rage against somebody else and pick on them. And, you know, and it's kind of ironic and kind of shocking that the someone else we are picking on is little toddlers in detention camps.
Yeah.
So
let me ask you about the similarity between that and a sports fan. I mean, we've seen some situations around the world and some sporting events where people have gotten pretty riled up over the supporting their team, and mm-hmm. we've seen violence and sometimes death in the stadium, people being crushed by the mobs and so forth. Is there a difference, or is that something a little bit different? Because we don't see the New York Yankee fans trying to dominate and destroy, you know, some other sport that's taking away attention from them or whatever other team we want to mention.
Well, they're probably not quite threatened by annihilation.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the anger and the vengeance and the hate is probably correlated to the fear.
And the phrase at the end of each season is, hey, there's always next year.
Yeah, but let's see if you go to 1932 in Germany, you know, where Germany felt very much threatened by to annihilation, the Great Depression, the First World War, the dismantling, the humiliation, all well deserved mm-hmm. because they started a war. But still, you know, that Germans just felt crushed, you know, in economically, their pride, everything crushed, identity. And so here comes a person, Mr. Hitler, who says, wow, you are actually somebody special. Mm-hmm. You are the Aryan race. You are better than others. Germany first and only first. And those Germans whose self-confidence was threatened and crushed and humiliated, they went for it.
Yeah.
They went for it and picked on somebody else, a little tiny religious minority, which were the Jews and the gypsies and the homosexuals and the people with mental illness. And in a way, you might say it's fake. Yes, it was a fake self-esteem, but for a little time it made them feel better until it made them feel worse. But for a while it made them feel better.
Yeah. It seems to be really tricky, this dynamic, and it's really seems really easy to fall into that path. And there are many people who feel that the United States is heading down that path of Germany.
Yeah, you know, we don't know. I mean, there are certainly a lot of...
I mean, there seem to be a lot of signs.
There are a lot of signs, and I guess we are right now in the state of, I call it radical uncertainty.
Yeah.
It could go down that path.
I guess the thing that's disheartening to me is that the only thing that is going to... And we saw this in January here in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's going to unite the people towards a common goal is a natural disaster. Hawaii, they've got the lava, so everybody's kind of hunkering together. We had the mudslides mm-hmm. in January. Then we've got we're in hurricane season, so we're waiting for those disasters to happen, and that'll bring the people together. And it's like, why can't we do that when we're not facing these kinds of disasters? And I guess I heard someone say that, well, because it's sort of bred into us as human beings, it's just part of our nature that that's really the only time during crisis when,
right.
you know, we kind of hunker together.
Well, that's interesting. You know, it's my mom, who was a medical student medic in the Second World War. She said that as long as the war was going on, people actually helped each other.
Mm.
And then a year or two after the war was over, they were all again in their little corners. And
yeah.
man, I hear that, unfortunately, from my clients from Montecito, you know, how much there was a helping hand towards each other during the time of crisis. And now there are a lot of lawsuits and fighting going on. And I have a friend who works there as one of the crisis workers, and she's describing that, you know. So, and I think it's also what we cultivate. I think part of it is human nature. You know, there are certain aspects to the human condition which are definitely problematic.
Yeah.
Our sense of competitiveness, of tribalism, of... us versus them, but then it's also what we cultivate.
Yeah.
There was recently a really interesting podcast by Sam Harris and Robert Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Wright being an evolutionary biologist, I think, or psychologist. And he's quite a famous guy. And he said that if we just leave it to evolution, genetic evolution, we are doomed.
Mm-hmm.
Because genetic evolution praises defending your tribe, being selfish,
mm-hmm.
being selfish, you know, just trying to survive yourself.
Yeah.
That might have helped with tribes in the past,
yeah.
but it doesn't help anymore now. It
yeah.
actually could destroy our planet. So he says we need something what he calls cultural evolution. We have to yeah. cultivate a different attitude, because genetic evolution isn't quick enough
mm-hmm. yeah,
to
it's
make
a slow
us
process.
To make us civilized.
Yeah.
And we need to be more civilized.
Yeah, what I see, my analogy before we go to break is we're all on this lifeboat, 7.6 billion of us. We're split in half. One half is on one side, one half is the other. And there are guys in the middle on either side with chainsaws cutting the lifeboat in half, not realizing that when you cut this lifeboat in half, we all are goners.
Right, exactly.
That's kind of what I'm seeing now. And, of course, I use that analogy when talking about this program and how we're searching for those new ways of living and that we have this lifeboat, and it'll hold 7.6 billion people.
Yeah.
But there's only one condition on entering the lifeboat. You have to be willing to let go of the old ways of doing things because they don't work. We're not taking them with us. However, we actually are, unless we have that cultural evolution within ourselves, especially if we don't change ourselves inside. Yeah, we're just taking the old ways with us anyway, and so we've individually got lots of work to do.
Well, individually and as little groups,
mm-hmm. and as groups, yes.
You know, I think this is a time where we have to get to work.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program and for sharing. And we're going to continue this discussion here on the other side of the break. And it is Radley Weininger. And we're talking about a lot of different things here. The title of your book, once again, that we talked about it last time you were on the program.
Mm-hmm. It's called Hard Work, The Path of Self-Compassion, and has a foreword by Jack Kornfield. And it's published by Shambhala Publications.
I like
and
that, Shambhala. I know.
And I know Chosos has it.
Mm-hmm. And the website you'd want to send people to get more information?
RadleyWeiningerPhD.com.
And we are linked, and we'll be linked with this interview as well. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Radley Weininger, and we're talking about, of course, Hard Work, her latest book, and also other issues that we're going to get into as well. And thank you for staying with us here on the program. It's been nice to have you.
Nice to have you. Thank you so much.
Your background, you know, we've talked off the air. Of course, we talked in our previous program earlier in the year as well. And I think about some of the things we've already talked about in this program and thinking, well, gee, you know, if I could just find a place where I could just disconnect from all of that stuff and just, I don't know, meditate and om and all of those wonderful spiritual things that supposedly are the outward manifestations of a heart that's trying to live a better life and show that to other people, things would be so much better, so much easier. I've even heard it said that those people who do live the monastic life around the world are the glue that are holding everything together. And if they stopped, you think it's chaotic now, it would really be crazy if they stopped their chanting and their praying and their supporting holding the space for us, as the phrase goes. What are your thoughts on not necessarily doing that, you know, becoming a monk or a nun or those types of things, but in terms of incorporating some kind of spiritual anchor?
Okay, they're two different things. I want to just not mix up.
Okay.
One is what I might call a certain kind of escapism, spiritual escapism, or I think a word that's often used is spiritual bypass, to bypass not only the ugly, nitty-gritty emotional realities, but also the ugly, nitty-gritty world, social, environmental realities. And I don't know the effect of monks sitting in monasteries and chanting. That might be great, you know, let them do this. I've personally, even though I have a strong spiritual practice, since I spent actually time in a monastery in 1980 in Sri Lanka, I don't believe that. I feel my calling personally is more to relieve suffering here right now, or to at least be a tiny little part of that. And I think to turn away from the realities of the world and try to find some little pocket where we can hide in a spiritual reality, I think that could backfire or bite us in the heel. I personally think we have to do more. And when the Buddha said the first noble truth is there's suffering and we have to find freedom from suffering, it's not only a mental kind of trick.
Right.
It's we have to, you know, if we are all interdependent and if everything is interdependent, like the Dalai Lama so often says, that also means we are all family, we are all kin, we are all interconnected. And that also means we have everybody in our heart. You know, we cannot disconnect and say this isn't our problem. It's all our problem.
Yeah.
And that, so that's maybe the one thing I would say. The second thing I would say is, the second part of the question is that I think it is very worthwhile to have a spiritual practice, to have a kind of a refuge inside, a kind of an anchoring in an aspect of reality that's beyond our chaos.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we flee there and hide there, but it does really help me to meditate early in the mornings, which I usually do for an hour, and connect to that place where we all are interconnected and where we can connect to what's there before chaos entangled us.
Mm-hmm.
And then to bring that, you know, and to come with a clear mind, with some wisdom and compassion back to the workplace, you might say.
Yeah. I would think that the first part of that is maybe the thoughts of escapism.
Yeah.
I got to get away. I mean, what do we do when the fire is raging in the hills? We run. You know, we want to get away from it.
We can't run away from the world.
No, we cannot. We cannot. And you know, it's like a fire raging. It'll burn all the way down to the beach. But, you know, everything is then destroyed. And if we don't do something to fight it to some degree, and I mean, we've heard the stories of heroic efforts to save, get life out of the way. Now we're going to try to save property. We're going to do the best we can. These are the firefighters and so forth. But in some instances, with some fires, there's just nothing you can do. I still remember the fire that was burning up in Yellowstone. This was back in the, I don't know, the late 90s, maybe the early part of the 2000s. And this was burning like in September, October. And they said, there's nothing we can do. We're just going to have to let it burn until the snows come, which is what they did. And then eventually it went out.
But they knew snow was coming.
But they knew snow was coming, yeah. God forbid that it had started in the spring. That would have been quite devastating. But then you've got things like that you can't really fight, like this lava flow in Hawaii. I mean, there's nothing you can do. You can't put it out. You can't stop it. There's no barricade you can put up to keep it from moving. And yet in our lives, with the actions of other people that affect us all the time,
mm-hmm.
would you say on a spiritual level that even if we were to turn off the TVs and the radios mm-hmm. and stop reading the news mm-hmm. and stop getting that information, that there would still be a part of us that would pick up on that energy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think actually—
we'd still be aware.
Yes, I do think on some level we are. And I noticed, you know, I see about 30 plus clients in my private practice every week. I can see there's a certain kind of malaise. And my sweet friend and ex-husband, Ruben Weininger, who's a psychiatrist in town, he says what's happening politically and socially right now is like a bad flu. You know, like a bad flu to the system. And he sees it in his patients. Mm. And I see it in mine. And C.G. Jung, you know, the famous psychologist, he said he saw it in people's dreams way before the Second World War. He saw signs of what was about to come. And he talked about the collective unconscious. There isn't just the personal unconscious or the whatever universal thing there is, but there's also a collective unconscious, a field where we are not separate of each other, and we don't know what energy really is. You know, science is very smart, but we talked about that a little bit before. We don't really know what that is, but we definitely pick it up. But there's one very interesting thing I noticed, and I think you mentioned that when you started talking now after the break. When we, no matter what, start to help another. You know, we are there, we are kind of overcoming our own fear and our wish for escaping and tuning out and numbing out and just satisfying ourselves. And we are actually reaching out to another, whether it works or not. You know, it doesn't matter that much. We actually feel better. We feel less depressed. We feel more empowered. And I actually have a word for that. I just wrote an article on it, which I'm just sending out this week. It's called the bodhicitta effect, Bodhicitta is in Tibetan Buddhism a word for caring for the well-being of all, the longing, the wish to care and to act on behalf of the well-being of all. So if we do that, you know, if we get over our own little self-preoccupation and selfishness, and we actually do something to care for the well-being of all, it comes back to us like a positive boomerang. It increases our own self-esteem or self-worth or sense of self, and we feel less afraid because we feel more connected. We feel more empowered because we don't feel helpless. Mm-hmm. And we feel less isolated because we are actually more connected. Mm-hmm. So I'm advocating to keep that in mind.
It makes me think of a philosophy I adopted many years ago when working primarily with clients and advertisers and so forth. You know, we think about this in the context of capitalism and entrepreneurism and so forth, mm-hmm. about being successful, right? Well, my philosophy has been, and even to this day is, that I don't want to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with the advertiser. I want to make you successful, because in turn, if I make you successful, then I'm successful. But if I focus on just me, mm-hmm. and putting money in the bank and then getting all the stuff with that and on and on and on, that's, and again, I know people, that's where mm-hmm. they are, and mm-hmm. I'm no criticism, no judgment, but that's my philosophy, and I try to live by that. I want to make you successful. I want to make your business, whatever product or service you're trying to put out there. Matter of fact, I was just at a fast food, well, sort of fast food, I guess you'd call it, a place called Dave's Dogs in Goleta on Hollister. I went in there and I was chatting with Dave. We'd had him on one of the other programs. And I was just really enjoying talking with him. And he was very personable. I'm going, wow, I like this guy, you know. And said, hey, we need to put together this, that, and the other thing. It was just a wonderful experience. And the guy is looking pretty darn successful. There's not much more I can add to what he's doing other than if he were to expand to someplace else in Santa Barbara. But that's, I think, really what you're talking about, too, is that it's not that we're sacrificing ourselves.
No, we are not.
That's not it. I mean, and I'm not sacrificing my success for someone else's. I know that, as you said, mm-hmm. from a universal and spiritual standpoint, mm-hmm. what you put out comes back to you, whether you want to call it karma, whether you want to call it the golden rule, whatever you want to term it.
Yeah, or actually physics nowadays.
Physics, exactly.
That everything
Einstein?
Well, Einstein and after.
For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
And there's an observer-participant effect.
I remember maybe this is the same story where the scientists were conducting an experiment.
Yeah.
And every time the experiment came out differently.
Yeah.
And they couldn't figure out at first why.
So our participation changes what is happening.
Right.
And so if we know this, that our deepest reality is not to be isolated, to be separate, but that we are interdependent and interconnected, if that is really the deepest reality of the universe, if we act in accordance to that, with that flow, then actually there is a sense of rightness or happiness that arises from that. And that's what I call the bodhicitta effect.
You know, what's interesting is what we talked about in the first segment, which was, you know, a little depressing and disheartening, but this bodhicitta effect, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good.
Is what we need to resolve those issues we talked about in the first segment.
Right.
To come to grips with.
I sent you my article. I just finished it yesterday.
Oh, well, I haven't had a chance to read it yet as of this conversation. But mm-hmm. what I'm getting is that if we begin that process, it doesn't mean, and I know that there are people who have certain beliefs, philosophical bents, if you will, on participating in our democracy in a specific way.
Right.
But I'm sitting here thinking, well, wait a minute. Why do I have to participate that way? Aren't there other ways that I can participate? And I'm using that term mm-hmm. in the context of the bodhicitta effect.
Yeah.
That can affect that kind of change, that can affect that kind of transformation, mm-hmm. which is kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think it's good that everybody wonders what makes my heart sing. So in my article, I bring the example of a woman, Kelly, mm-hmm. who was in my meditation group for a long time and got really discouraged by the politics now. She turned her TV off. She stopped reading the news, and she turned to knitting. She went with her lady friends to women's knitting, mm-hmm. and they decided to not to talk about politics, not to talk about world affairs, to only talk about their own grandchildren and maybe just very personal things. Mm-hmm. And she became very depressed. It just didn't work. It wasn't enough. And she got more and more kind of feeling hopeless and disempowered. And then a friend of hers says, why don't you join the Big Sisters? You know, where somebody, big brothers, big sisters, you can become an advocate and a support to a child mm-hmm. or a teenager who doesn't have the right support or right. parents. And so she was linked up with a 14-year-old girl whose parents were deported, who got stuck with her relatives. And so then she ended up teaching this girl knitting and some of her girlfriends. And it became really important, you know, that for her and yeah. for this girl to have this connection. And she realized that after that, that her depression had lifted, that she felt more empowered. She felt less useless. Mm-hmm. She felt less isolated and superfluous, that she actually felt there was a sense of meaning. And I think meaning is a really important word. What really gives us meaning? I think we are also in a crisis of meaning these days.
Yeah. The thought flashed through my mind. There's a phrase often used when someone's telling a story and someone says, oh, you mean that your shoes were blue? And the comment reply would be, you mean that's what you took from that story? So I was thinking, so are you telling me that knitting is the cure to depression?
No. I think giving, and it's not knitting or not knitting, it's how you knit. Do you knit in isolation yeah. to escape the world?
It's the connection.
Or do you knit in order to help another yeah. and to connect and to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to say was that it doesn't matter if you knit or if you become an environmental activist mm-hmm. or if you demonstrate in front of a detention center or if you whatever you do, mm-hmm. Work in a nursing home, you know, it doesn't really matter. Choose something that makes you feel passionate. And if that's knitting, find a way where knitting can actually make our world a better place.
Mm. Well, that's what we're all about, is trying to make this a better place. But make this a better place for everyone.
For everyone.
Not just a select few.
Mm-hmm.
And not leaving out. I made the comment on a program not too long ago about how I realize there is the class system.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I realize it exists, but I wish it didn't.
Me too.
One of the things that I've also learned too is that for every job, and I mean every job, every task that needs to be done in our society, okay, there is someone who wants to do it, mm-hmm. genuinely wants to do it. They have a passion for it,
mm-hmm.
okay? Whether it's, and I'll use the term sanitation engineer, in my day of growing up, it was the garbage man.
Yeah.
Okay? There are people who want to do it. It's uh-huh. not something that got stuck in. I see the guys here in Santa Barbara running around the streets. You know, you've seen it too. I mean, and they're just hustling and a-bustling. And by the way, most of them I've noticed are pretty slim looking guys, okay? And I applaud them for obviously taking risk running between cars and things of that nature, but for doing this job, because if it weren't for them, our garbage would be piled up to the treetops.
And maybe it's more enjoyable than sitting at a desk.
Exactly.
You know, I have a funny story with that. I was a medical student in Germany studying anatomy and just being really frustrated. And I saw outside of my window the street sweeper. It was fall. All the leaves were falling.
Mm.
And he was just sweeping along. And I thought, oh, this would be such a great job to be a street sweeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so actually I called the city and applied to become a street sweeper.
Really?
They didn't take me.
Oh!
Oh!
Did they tell you why?
They said I was overqualified.
Well, I chuckle too sometimes when I see the street sweepers on State Street brooming the leaves or blowing them.
I love that.
When it's windy and there are still leaves on the trees falling.
Yeah.
I'm going, why don't you guys just wait until all of the leaves have fallen off the tree?
But, you know, I would have to say something to that. You know, my other article, which I sent you, Sisyphus the Bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. Sisyphus the Bodhisattva, it was came out in Lion's Roar and also in The Independent. You know, sometimes leaves are still falling.
Yeah.
And we are sweeping.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's also about disengaging ourselves from the product of our work. Our work is not just meaningful if it leads to a great outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is meaningful no matter what.
Right.
And we cannot control the outcome. We cannot control whether there will be more leaves or not. But it's kind of a Zen way, you know. Mm-hmm. You sweep because you sweep and you do the best sweeping job you can make, whether there are leaves or not.
Well, when I was working back in Phoenix to this same, it's kind of the same thing. I was walking across the square between two buildings, and the workmen were out there with their squeegees, squeegeeing off the square where everybody was walking because of the rainwater that had built up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were doing it in the middle of the rain shower. Same kind of thing. And I'm thinking, but what you sweep away is being replaced by what's falling, you know. And I just thought that was kind of a redundant, you know, a strange paradox from my perspective as I observed going, why don't you just wait until it stops raining, you know? And there wasn't like it was, you know, hip deep or anything. They were just trying to make sure that it was safe for people. And I got that. But and that's interesting that doing what we do, the joy of just doing it.
Yeah.
I have that same feeling. I mean, there are days, I'm not really, really excited about. But once I get into it, once I start doing it, I get into what they call the zone, like in sports, you know, when the guy's hitting threes every time he puts up a basketball, that whole malaise goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I am contributing to the community output. Community being the radio station output to those people who are listening.
Mm-hmm.
Those people who are interested or weren't interested before, but they are now because of the subject matter. Part of my role too is as a, so to speak, a cheerleader or a coach during the breaks, you know, trying to keep things lively, trying to keep the energy up, you know, so that the host and guests don't get too bogged down. You know, I was actually, I got to tell you, I was a little concerned about our first segment there, thinking, oh boy, this is going down a road. Yes, we need to talk about it. No question. It needs to be discussed. But at the same time, it's like, okay, I don't want to stay here too long.
It's too heavy.
It's too heavy. It gets too heavy after a while.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we ignore it. I don't know if I shared this with you in our last program. I struggle with the paradox of the ancient wisdom teachings teaching us where we have come from, the one, where we're going to, the one. But here we are here now in this dualistic world. Why? What is the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're going to the one, what difference does it make if we know about dualism and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
And then as I began to process that in my mind, I put myself out in the universe, out in the cosmos, amongst the stars and the planets and the solar systems. And then thinking, okay, what's going on out here? You've got stuff hurtling, spinning, doing all these things. You've got stars that are exploding and creating maybe new planets and this and that and the other thing. And from our perspective, from our dualistic mindset, chaos, destruction. But from the perspective of the universe, that's just what is. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And so we can maybe transform from that dualistic mindset to one of the oneness mindset by acknowledging that, all right, we taking into account what we talked about in the first segment, it's just what's happening and it's not permanent. Okay.
Well, I might even propose a third thing.
Please.
You know, there's the one here, I'm stuck in the dualistic mindset, left hand, right hand, the oneness. And I can see how you can start feeling, why even bother with the dualism if we come from and
we're going
come
to,
back to. But in Buddhist thinking, there is an interesting thought, which is, how can I hold both what I might call mundane and universal reality? And it's kind of a paradox, but they are both there. They are both, in some ways, I don't know, real, whatever is real is. You know, they are both tangible. And so to learn not to be only in one or the other, but to have a foot or a hand in both. You know, to be really engaged in the dualism to relieve suffering, because that suffering of those kids in detention centers and you and me and everybody, it is quite real. You know, it is felt. You know, and but from the universal reality, they say, well, it's not even real. So it's both. It is real and not real, or whatever. We don't even know what real is at the same time. And so to hold that paradox gracefully, I think, is what is necessary.
What about the concept of...
Does that make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense. Because one, if you get, so to speak, stuck, or you focus on just one of those two concepts, then in one of them, you're actually going to start to ignore, in a manner of speaking, the suffering.
Right.
But if you focus too much on the dualism, you're going to get sucked so far in that you may lose yourself in all of the pain and the suffering and all of the turmoil. But let me ask you another question in this light, because maybe it's a fourth perspective. All that's happening is being done by people, by individuals, okay? Now, maybe there is that collective cultural mindset that's going on too that we talked about. But they're still people. They're still individuals. You and I, we've been through our lives. Throughout our lives, we've had those moments, those catalytic moments that have transformed our lives. And I was going down this direction, and all of a sudden, this thing happened. And the next thing I know, I'm going a different direction, and I'm really enjoying this. I think of, for example, the example of Nelson Mandela in prison. He had two choices. Prison gave him the two choices. One was continue down the road he was going, of violence and so forth, or of love and peace.
Right.
And he chose the love and peace. And guess what? Guy became president of the of South Africa. Is it realistic to hope for, I don't know, to pray for, to send energy to these individuals to help them to maybe reach that catalytic moment of understanding that, hey, wait a minute, I'm not just responsible for me. I'm responsible for everybody in whatever the position, whether it's a supervisor at a plant or a manager of a radio station or leader of a country.
Well, yes, sure. It's good to send energy, but I think it's also great to see your own life because I think in small ways we all have these catalytic moments. I remember when I was 22 and I was a pretty unhappy student. My family was in disarray and I hated what I was studying and whatever, you know. And I had two car accidents within 3 months.
Oh, wow.
And I was 2 months in the hospital, actually. And I thought, wow, one more car accident, I'm not going to survive. You know, it just felt it was happening for no reason, you know, so seemingly. And in some ways, it became for me the turning point. And I really started thinking, what am I doing here? I have to do something different. And that's when I went to Sri Lanka and ended up in a monastery. And so looking back, I'm actually grateful for these car accidents, even though I still have my scars on my forehead. But, you know, if
they hadn't happened,
I wouldn't have been catapulted out of my as I call it, mediocre misery.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to recognize these turning points, whether it's a separation or loss of job or an illness, to start to see adversity as opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can clamp down, we can be taken in by fear, we can contract and become very self-absorbed in our misery, or it can become a way to expand, to actually get catapulted on a different level of awareness.
Yeah. What flashed in my mind was this recent incident. And I have to say that when I've taken a look at it from several different perspectives, I'm disheartened by the whole thing and that it even happened in this country. We had the president's spokesperson who was out to dinner one night, and they were tossed out of a restaurant because they worked for the president. And on the one hand,
a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, and on the kind of ironic.
So,
and on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, you know, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone we want. Now, you should have done that at the beginning of the meal, not in the middle, but nonetheless, we still reserve the right. And I thought, you know, karma's a real pain, isn't it? You know, a payback is, as they say, a bitch. And then I got to thinking, is this what we've come to in this country? Is this how far down the rabbit hole we've gone that this is the way we're treating one another? That, I mean, when I was working, for example, for Channel 3, KEYT, back in 2007, and then this job here at the Santa Barbara News Press came along, I was sharing that with people. Oh, I'm going to be the operations manager, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you're going to work for the dark side? And I said, there is no dark side. We're all on the same side. And, of course, they were talking, of course, about all the controversies of the previous few years in particular. And I just thought, are you kidding me? I'm a broadcaster. You know, I'm this or that or whatever the title I want to take.
Yeah.
I'm not on anybody's side. And even when I work for a given radio station or facility, my job isn't to compete with any of the other stations. My job is to make the work I do and the people that I relate with and the company that I'm working for better than it was yesterday and hopefully better tomorrow than it is today. I don't care about the competition. The competition's irrelevant to me.
My competition
is internal where I'm working. I need to improve this place.
That's true, unless you get censored.
Well, that's true. And I worked for a station where I was working for a station that I didn't find until after the fact that it was considered to be a tax write-off for the owner of the station. And, of course, they didn't want any improvements. They didn't want to raise the ratings because if they did that, then it wouldn't be a tax write-off anymore because it was now making money and it was successful.
Yeah, that's very unethical.
Yeah, it's unethical, and it's frustrating for those of us who don't know that that's the reason why the company's there, you know. So, you know, I've worked in both environments, and it's, you know, it's again, as I say, very disheartening. I realize that we are fast approaching our time on this particular edition of the program. I am definitely going to have you back again, and hopefully sooner rather than last time you were on. We had you on in April, so maybe I can have you on in, I don't know, September, October, and we'll converse. And talk more about these kinds of things, and also some of these articles. I would love to talk even more about this
bodhicitta
effect, and really enlighten our listeners as to that effect. I want to remind our listeners that you can go to her website, and the website is, and I'm going to spell it for you: RADHULEWEININGER. PhD is what they've got here, .com. But we are linked to your website. So they just click on your name on our website and they're there. And again, we're excited to have you here on the program and participating in what we're doing here and making this world a better place.
Thank you so much. It's always really enjoyable to talk to you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.